Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. I'd like to welcome all of you back to Ohio Exopolitics. I'm your host, Mark Snyder. We've got a guest this evening. We've got Glenn Steckling on the line, and we've got a new book to talk about. I'd like to welcome Glenn back to the show. It looks like my studio is just kind of spinning here for a moment, folks, so we'll get Glenn on here shortly. The book is called The Extraordinary People, Power, and Events Behind the Flying Saucer Mystery 2. It's a book written by George Adamski, and I think Glenn should be there. Glenn, how are you this evening?
Evening, Mark. How are you doing? Glad to be with you.
I'm glad to be with you once again, and I enjoyed reading this book very much. What was the inspiration for this book?
Well, the original book, Flying Saucers, Farewell, and not farewell in the case of goodbye, but fare thee well was basically what that meant. But Flying Saucers, Farewell was published in 1961. And then again in the 1970-74 as the secondary title behind the Flying Saucer Mystery in paperback. And a lot of the information is extremely relevant and gives a great deal of explanation into a lot of the questions that surround the UFO enigma and extraterrestrial visitations. And so it was on our schedule for quite a while to make this book again public. And it took some time because it's always a lot of work. I added 55 pages of what I call vindication, really, of George, scientific information, all kinds of facts, and evidence in order to support what George said since the time that he passed away until now. And that was only a fraction, 55 pages. We could have probably done a whole book on that. And also added about 22 pages new that the original never contained of photographs and newspaper articles of his world tour, his interactions with Queen Juliana, and a lot of pictures and letters that came from his private files and correspondence with people like Frank Edwards and the government and so on and so forth. So I have found lately, especially on YouTube, there's a lot of George bashing going on by people who haven't a clue of what they're talking about, and they just hope that they can invent facts. And I wanted to put this out so people actually had source material to go to. And I've got about 5 pages of references in there, very much in the same vein as you would find in a college paper, in order to substantiate all the sources from where that information came from. So I saw this as threefold. One, to give the people who remember George in those times a bit of a boost. Two, to answer a lot of the garbage that's out there. And three, so the new generation who is unaware and untainted about a lot of the innuendo and opinions in this field could take up a book, take a look at it, look at the references, do some research on their own, and could find some actual substance concerning both George and this field. So I think it was a long time coming, and it was just a matter of the 2 years' work in order to get everything together, because, of course, we have volunteers that work side by side, and we all have professions and jobs, and you know, we have to take care of our family and pay the bills like everybody else. So we operate the foundation purely as a nonprofit educational entity.
Well, I love the quotes in the beginning of the book. One that really caught my eye is from what's called the Hebrew Book of Life, which stated that there were men from the sky on the earth in those days. It made me want to read on and find out what else it had to say along those lines.
Well, yes, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the amount of publications and research that have been done towards the ancient texts, the biblical texts, both of the area around Palestine and Israel, and also in ancient India and Tibet and in many different areas around the world. I think, you know, the Babylonians and Syria, and the work that others have done in the Mediterranean area, but you know, all over the planet, we get to see that there is always descriptions of human beings that come amongst us, perhaps with a little bit more enlightenment and greater awareness and skills and technology that we are willing to admit to, but they have always come amongst us, our civilizations, and try to give us a little boost up.
Do you think we had extraterrestrial humans here in large numbers in the ancient past, maybe 10, 20,000 years ago?
I don't know what you would say as large numbers, but I would say that there were substantial numbers that interacted with our ancient societies. And I think that, once again, the records speak for themselves. And we have tried to bury that in so-called mythology and whitewash it, because anthropologically and archaeologically, we try to maintain a certain timeline, a status quo that we teach our children in school and try to promote. And so we have found, and other authors have written the same thing, that a certain amount of ancient evidence is either destroyed or whitewashed or buried, whether it happens to be the age of the Sphinx, which has water erosion that hasn't seen water in 20, 30,000 years.
Right.
Or you look at the prehistoric etchings in Yalta that were, they were encouraged to chisel it off the wall so people wouldn't go in there and try to promote it. And it goes on in many different fields, but there is a definite pattern of suppression and trying to maintain a status quo of thinking and dogma.
Now, you just mentioned etchings on the walls. Where was that? You said Yalta?
I believe that was. Yeah, I read a publication where we were talking about what you call prehistoric. And, of course, there's, you know, you're talking about the famous cave paintings in France that go back to the Neanderthal times. And you look at Professor Marcel Humay's discovery in the Brazilian jungle that go back, you know, 10, 20,000 years, and a number of other individuals, and they are talking about the evidence of the carvings and depictions that are located around the globe, and there are areas where certain individuals have been paid and promoted in order to destroy these things so that there doesn't come into question what's going on. And some of this comes from the academic side, you know, curriculums as well, because there's a lot of positions and a lot of what we call degrees and notoriety that has been attained and promoted, just like many other fields, corporations and politics, and everybody wants to protect their own hide. And so, you know, new discoveries, science is supposed to be about new discoveries, new revelations. And we're extremely reluctant to truly go towards those new discoveries and revelations.
I remember in the book it mentioned where, I guess it was on George's property near Mount Palomar, where a craft flew over treetop level and it dropped a package. Can you tell us about that?
Well, there were a couple things. Yeah, the after the initial meeting out in Desert Center on November 20th, there was George had an old camera, the type of camera that used emulsion plates, glass plates, and he had a couple of these plates in his pocket. So when he interacted with the extraterrestrial, the fellow pointed at his pocket. So George took out one of the plates and handed it to him, and he put it away in one of his pockets, and George thought that was the end of it. About 3 weeks later, one of these craft flew low level, about treetop, and hovered, and out of a hatch dropped the package, except for in this case, the package now, the glass plate has a series of etchings in it. And you'll find in the book in the illustration sections as well the photograph of those etchings, along with the etchings found by Professor Humay about 10 years later in the Brazilian jungle, and the continuity between both sets. So the idea was that this information had not been just given to one person at one time, but had circulated around the earth in many different societies at different times. And so these particular symbols, in relationship to the other symbols that George had taken from the desert contact, where symbols were on the bottom of the visitor's soles of his shoes, very much like we wear tennis shoes now with different tread designs and things on the bottom, that's the same kind of idea. And so they took a plaster cast and they used those symbols in combination with those, and a South African fellow by the name of Basil Vandenberg deciphered it and built a small free energy electromagnetic model. And he was going to go public with it, called a press conference from about 20 or so countries. And he had corresponded with George, and George said, "You've got to watch out. This is extremely careful, sensitive information. And there are powers that be that do not wish this kind of free energy system or world-altering information to go public to the masses." So Vandenberg did it anyway, and he got on an airplane and flew through a through flight through Switzerland, and he was never seen again.
Wow!
And so that was, you know, just the beginning of that. Now later in the book, another aerospace engineer was in 57 visiting George on the property, and there were like 20, 30 other people there at the time. And that account is also in the book, and I have Alan's file and his affidavits and have, exclusive rights and usage to that, and much more of that will come out. But he witnessed one of these craft fly low level and actually touched down on the property. And in the book, it describes what he had seen and the fact that he had seen them while he was serving in Korea in the armed forces as a Marine before that. And later, the fact he worked for the aerospace industry, Allied Signal, and also the Department of Defense in electromagnetics. And he holds several patents. The last time I visited him about a year ago, he showed me one of the machines that they had built during the government. He worked as a contractor for NASA. And he has almost what you could call a perpetual motion machine. They have developed something that is hovering in a magnetic field. It, once set in motion, seems to go on. And they said after 30 days of setting it in motion, in 30 days they collected the data, and it never slowed down. It just kept spinning. And so some of that technology NASA had sold to a foreign country, because they didn't think it was worth their while, and then they had to spend a lot of money trying to buy it back. So both those accounts are in the new book, and I thought would be quite greatly eye-opening to the general public.
Well, let me make sure I got this story straight. So George had a meeting, a face-to-face meeting, with one of these extraterrestrials, and gave this fellow a plate, which
a glass
later
plate.
Which later was engraved with symbols, and was it Professor Hamid?
Homet. His name is Marcel Homet, H-O-M-E-T, and he wrote several books. One of them, he was an anthropologist, he wrote several books. One of them was called The Son of the Sun, and On the Trail of the Sun God. And basically, what he did through historical records is determined that at one time, the Amazon basin was a shallow lake, and therefore civilizations would be around the perimeter or the coastline, just like they are now, of this large inward lake. And so he went about expedition-wise, very much in the same vein as Colonel Fawcett, except for he went north instead of south to an area called the Piedra Pintada, or the Painted Rock, but several other areas as well, and found archaeological remains of stone cities. And in this particular thing, they found a lot of these symbols. And these symbols are also indicative of other cultures, Pacific Rim cultures and Egyptian and what have you. So there's a great deal of overlay between ancient civilizations.
So the extraterrestrial that George gave the plate to had these symbols etched on the plate, and the symbols themselves were 20,000 to 30,000 years old in terms of when they originated.
Well, the ones that Marcel Homet, Professor Homet, found, he estimated at least 10,000 years old based upon geophysical weathering and what have you. And he guesstimated there would be at least 10,000 where he found his evidence declared at least 10,000, possibly even older, 20 or 30,000. But the glass plate, there about is an 80% continuity between the sets of symbols. And when, if you look in the illustration section of the book, you can see the two of them set side by side. And then there's a row of them where they are matched one for one, and they're extremely close. So,
did the extraterrestrials ever tell George what the symbols meant?
Yes. Yeah, they were the key to propulsion systems. And so when he... when George became a worked lengthy with two fellows, T.T. Brown and also Agnew Bonson. And both of them had pro-gravity research labs on the East Coast. And in fact, Brown ended up doing some work for Bonson, and Bonson was a friend of George. And so there was a collaboration going on as far as the series of experiments, electromagnetic-wise, frequency-wise, megahertz-wise, so on and so forth. So for all the people that claim that George was a kook, his scientific evidence sure was spot on, because otherwise laboratories wouldn't waste their time experimenting in those fields and fine-tuning based upon his recommendations. That's also in the book.
Yeah, I found the symbols. They're in two columns, one labeled Adamski and the other labeled, I guess, Brazil.
Or Home A, yeah, let me see here on the page. But, yeah, that's a comparison. Mm-hmm.
Very interesting.
Yeah,
so,
I mean, I'd say that like as we mentioned before, these type of contacts and these type of information and propulsion systems, if you look at ancient Chinese text through 4,000 to 5,000 years old, Hindu and Indian as well, they talk about, you know, flying chariots and mapping from aerial observation points high up in the sky. Only the way you could determine all the geographical features, very much like being able to be in a high altitude and look down on the plains of Nazca and look at the depictions there as well. So it was not exclusive material, just, shall we say, a reawakening of that material.
It was very, very interesting. And a fellow named Vandenberg ended up creating a free energy device just by looking at these symbols?
That's correct. He worked on the translation of them and the application and of course, some other information as well that George passed on. But he did develop a device. There was a picture of it. It was published. And he wrote an article that said, "My discoveries will prove Adamski's claims."
That's interesting. Now, wasn't your father invited to the Pentagon to show some of Adamski's films?
Yes. In the 1960s, since my parents and my family were close co-workers of Adamski and had witnessed these spacecraft with Adamski and some of his contacts, when George passed away, my father carried on the momentum of that work on the East Coast, and due to that, he was very active. He went to the Pentagon, Colonel Freeman, NASA, Goddard with Dr. Lohman and 22 scientists. He was on Voice of America almost every other month. My mother went along with Madeleine Rutherford of the Senate Space Committee. There was a lot of media and press and things like that. There was a lot of activity then because, of course, you had the 1968 hearings of Professor McDonald and other noted scientists who were pushing hard for Congress to let this information out. And the powers that control Congress are the ones that will determine what comes out and what doesn't. These people that sit in the Capitol have really nothing to say. But the publicity was a great deal of push at that time, at least until 69 and Nixon came into office.
So your father was on the Voice of America fairly often.
Mm-hmm. Yes, he was.
I think this is the Voice of America. It's in Westchester, Ohio, where I grew up. I mean, it's a massive set of just these towers, radio towers, all over, and it's interesting. I've met people, you know, in other countries that listen to that all the time. I guess there's really no need for that nowadays since the internet Would you agree?
Well, that's true. Remember, we were in the midst and height of a Cold War, and nuclear proliferation was on everybody's minds, and rightfully so. So there was this titanic struggle between different ideologies, and Voice of America was broadcast high level broadcast all over the planet, so that people with radios and shortwave and in many undeveloped countries were able to listen to a more, shall we say, free representation of the media's broadcasting.
How did George make his living?
George lived on the property that was owned by his students, Alice K. Wells, who was one of his students already since the 30s, and he ran a school. And his wife and the rest of the people lived on this property, and basically between the functions of talking to the public and taking the photographs and interacting with the scientists up at Palomar Village with the Hale Observatory, they all contributed in a communal way. One did plumbing, the other one did electrics, the other one helped build. And so it was very much a farm-like community. Where they had moved from before in Valley Center, they had actually ran a farm. And so when it came to this material, George basically gave it away. Most of his contracts for the overseas publications in foreign languages and inside the spaceships was published in God knows probably a dozen languages around the world. That was all done freely without royalties or fees. You know, they keep claiming George made a lot of money. Well, that's a bunch of BS, because the man never owned a car, never owned a house, didn't have a bank account to speak of, just a few grand when he passed away, and had three suits. So they really don't know what the hell they're talking about, as usual.
Gosh, that's interesting. It's a not a very materialistic lifestyle.
Well, no, he didn't particularly. You know, George used to have the same faith that I think many of our theologians have in many different denominations, that life will present itself and will take care of those who are trying to support it. And he said, you know, they may have not been, shall we say, wealthy or very well-to-do, but they had food on the table, they had a place to sleep and stay, they had the basics of what they needed. And, you know, and for the people that were on the property, there were one or two cars versus, you know, you look in the driveway of everybody's house now, there's two or three cars, if not more. And so I think it came from a simpler time. We'd come out of the post-war era of World War II. You know, there was a great building and replenishing of our nation and other nations around the world. And so I think people were more just willing to be a bit more normal and a little bit less materialistic. Now it's gone the total other extreme where that's all they live for.
George talked about there being four types of visitors: one human, another humanoid, one robotic, one android. And can you elaborate on that? Tell us a little bit about that.
Sure. George, by the way, is not the only one who spoke of that. The scientists spoke of that. There's a couple other publications, Hollywood versus the Aliens. The author of that spoke of the same thing. And there's another book out that I quoted also there in the resource sections that eludes me right now, the name of it. But also the talk of that. And basically the same thing applies when I had discussions with certain scientists, which I had a few years ago out in the southwestern United States. And it came down to this: the evolution of species, no matter where you go, the principles of nature are universal. This isn't Star Trek or Star Wars or a total abandonment of nature's principles, which exist not only on this planet for creation, it exists everywhere else. There is a template, and nature is very orderly, while we in our minds are very confused, for the most part. And so they talked about the natural cycle of things. So, for instance, the whale might be the smartest creature that exists in the ocean, but he's still regulated to the ocean. He doesn't have that type of development that will bring him into land or on space or anywhere else. And the same thing goes for the other species. Each one has its own individual frequency, like a radio station. And that species stays within that species. There's no jumping around. You're not going to be a monkey one time and a person the next and a dolphin the next and a horse the next time. That's all. Ridiculous if you understand even the rudimentary principle. And so when they talk, not only George, but others talk about the human genome, that is a universal genome, and the space travelers have indicated through the millions of years and millions of miles that they've traveled space, that the human genome is a common manifestation, not something that's rare and unusual. The robotics are simply the assistants that are built either from early societies to police the society, which in my opinion would be a wonderful thing to have here, because there are no rules and regulations and consequences to anything that people do. And there is really no law. The law is for a few. And others gather the consequences when there's a lot of innocence involved too. So you really need a neutral police force or a neutral force altogether in order to maintain a certain standard of civilization. Robots are developed to work on the craft between the hulls, where you have greater radiation, greater consequences from the electromagnetics. You can use them as probes when you go to planets. You can put them on the surface to recover data. And Android is nothing more than a scientific involvement of the robot itself. And so earlier craft, when they recovered them, whether it happens to be Roswell, Cortez, Alamosa, White Sands, and many of these other places, some of the public does know and some of them they haven't a clue. But the robotics that they recovered are just that, which we are presently coming to in our own technology. The Android is a refinement of that. But they are used to do the work that would be endangering to human beings. Not only that, it frees the human beings up to pursue other more talented goals. Here we have this attitude that look at the cotton gin. Cotton gin's invented. It helps production. It helps the people who had to harvest the cotton, the poor people. But in technology-wise, we kind of stagnate. We would rather have a whole population of people picking strawberries bend over than to develop the machine to do it, to alleviate the stress of having human beings having to do that. But then we say, well, the human beings don't have jobs and they're going to suffer. And that's because we don't promote the creation of new technologies and new positions and new jobs. We basically try to tell the people, always we can go backwards. We can retrieve the past, our greatness in the past, or our technologies and industry of the past. And that never works. You can never go backwards, no matter what you do in life. And so that's what these are for. The humanoids are basically a variation of the humans. Like, for instance, when you have, let's put it this way. We are, to a certain extent, thought. There's an old saying, as a man thinketh or as a person thinketh, so is he. When you exhibit coarse, aggressive, violent, shall we say, the baser instincts, then you betray those instincts, both in your emotion, in how the emotion affects how your facial features are, and so on and so forth. When you grasp that of finer understanding, then you also exhibit that finer thought. And so there is a change, a slight change in how the form represents the thought of the person that lives within it. And that's when it comes to those four categories. But as far as animals and insects and reptilians and crayfish and crawfish and praying mantis and all this other stuff, there's the scientific community just scoffs at that, and rightfully so, because it has no basis in reality.
I know, since our because of our past conversations, that one of the things that you're really concerned about is the massive population that's on the earth right now. And I agree with you wholeheartedly with that. Did George talk about that at all?
Well, he spoke of it to this point. He said, and I think some of it is in the second half of the book is, like I said, Flying Saucers Farewell, and there's this chapter in there called What He's Learned from the Interplanetarians. And I think to some degree he describes how they live and how they operate and what they believe and how society is composed for them. But he made a clear statement that they do not overpopulate the planet and they do not stretch its resources towards limits. Because this is not rocket scientists here, Mark. We know from our own basic experimentations, you put too many rats in the box and then you have chaos, pandemonium, cannibalism and everything else. And so basically it works to the same extent of anything that you put too many in an enclosed, confined area. And that's basically what you have. And so since there is no education of people to say, hey, you know, we overproduce due to religious beliefs, to based on old traditions, when we had to work the farm and there was no one else there and we needed large families to do that, and many other reasons to politically dominate or religiously dominate and to basically overrun other societies and countries by sheer numbers. These all exasperate the planetary conditions. When I was once in Israel, I listened to an Arab economist, and he was extremely forthright. And he said, our greatest problem is overpopulation. And the fact that population grows so quickly that there is no way that you can possibly create the tens of millions of jobs and positions and security and education that you overpopulate the region by year after year. And we know the numbers. It's about 85 million more people are born every year than passed away.
That's incredible. Think about that. 85 million more.
Every year.
Staggering.
And when you think about it, then you look at the people who will tell you honestly, there is no society, there's no place on the planet where you can absorb those numbers. Even if every country would take 5 million more a year, which would just totally devastate the system, infrastructure, water, electricity, economics, it still wouldn't be a drop in the bucket based upon the overproduction of people. So yes, I read recently that some scientists are saying that we are the only species capable of causing its own extinction through overpopulation.
Well, I think in your book you mentioned that we may reach 15 billion people within two generations.
That's correct. Those are their projections, not mine, but the math doesn't lie.
That's just astonishing. I work in Columbus now in a kind of a high building up on the sixth floor, and they've got some, you know, glass wraparound windows there. And the company that I work for, they have a little break room there where you get this incredible view, but it's right next to the 270 going north and south. And during high traffic times, there's just so many cars, and you can see them 3 or 4 miles of just cars. It's just incredible. That perspective really, really had an impact on me. When you start to see these, you know, even if you're in it, you don't really appreciate it until you can step back and see it from a distance. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I was going to say here on the West Coast, you used to have traffic banks, you know, between L.A. and San Diego. And you would know that if you got on the freeway before 3 o'clock, you would, you know, get the front of the bank. And then in the morning, if you got either on the freeway before 6 a.m. or after 9 a.m., you could, you know, time yourself through it. Now, the traffic is almost 24/7. And you can tell by the fact that we continue to add lanes and grind up dirt and expand our highway system slowly, and we can't keep up with the growth. No matter what we do, it's gridlock regardless. And so we are facing certain truths, and that's to a certain degree why we dumb down the public. We don't give them too much information. They don't get too much education. That way, they don't have higher expectations. And they wait for a generation to cycle through, so they can't ask those questions that, or they remember a time when things were different. Another generation from now, and they won't have a clue.
It certainly looks that way, which is very disturbing. One of the things that also disturbs me a lot is, at least from my commute every day, I've got a pretty long commute. I can see so many dead animals, deer and raccoons, and I counted 20 dead animals on my commute into Columbus, which one day, and I call the Earth now the planet of unnecessary death, because I think that's where we're headed.
Well, like, again, it's not because we can't do something better. It is because we're constantly told that it has to be cheaper. We are now running a system that says, well, let's use a bidding system in order to construct anything. And the lowest bid then gets the award. Well, think
right.
about that. Think about it. If it costs you $100, let's say, to build something, and somebody comes in there and says, I'll do it for $50, and the price of materials are almost that, then somewhere they've got to skimp, and they've got to provide a lesser product. And so we start
right.
keep getting the worst of quality, and the taxpayer is paying the most of the money. And then we just completely recycle, okay, it falls apart, let's build it again, and so on and so forth. You know, we have perpetual motion in order to keep job security, so to speak. But yes, we have the technology to build underpasses, and they build the Alaskan pipeline, and they put caveats and bypasses in for the wildlife and stuff like that. But then somebody always complains, oh, why, that's such a big deal, that costs too much money, blah, 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 blah. Unfortunately, we have come to a system where every little thing has to be justified by a monetary value. We won't let the butterfly exist unless we can say, oh, well, it cost us less to exterminate them than they are worth. Or if you can't find the value of this or that, or, you know, the value of incarcerating somebody versus the death penalty, and so on and so forth. Everything has been tacked on a stupid monetary value, and your existence on whether you are going to survive or prosper or flourish is based upon somebody else's allocation of your economic value, and I cannot see how this train is not headed for a massive wreck eventually.
Do you think that the space visitors still live and work among us?
I think they visit us. Their numbers are less right now based on my information, and also the fact that they focus their endeavors in areas where they are more welcome. The doors here in this country and the Western world slam pretty hard shut, and they moved a lot of their education and contact and what have you, to foreign countries, some to Russia, some to the Asian Peninsula, some to the African and South American and what have you. But we have pretty much posted the sign out front, you're not welcome. And we continue to promote that type of mentality. And so, you know, as a wise, intelligent being, you go somewhere else. If you're not wanted here, then you can go help somebody somewhere else. It's not whom you help, it's the fact that you help. And that's a universal principle. Where we hear, it's always, well, who gives us, you know, if I go help or contribute to charity, who's going to be watching, who's going to take the picture, who's going to do this and that. I think former President Carter is a magnificent person, truly one of the few people who actually lives what he believes and doesn't give it lip service.
Mm-hmm.
And at 91, he still goes out and builds for the poor, and it doesn't make any difference who the poor are. He just contributes. That's the type of individuals that the space people are as well. They come and they are not divisive. They don't have biases. They contribute where they can and to whom they can based upon the moment. And that is all that matters, because principally that what's important. And then, of course, they can go home. Well, the rest of us are stuck here for the time being.
Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like the universal principle is kind of a brotherly type of love.
Well, yes, in some society, yes, in some, no. I mean, let's be honest. Not everything that comes from space is benevolent. At the same token,
right.
Not everything that comes from space is aggressive and here to do you harm. That is greatly, grotesquely promoted, and that shows a total ignorance of the ability to travel space successfully, the amount of technology and scientific advancement civilization-wise, several thousand years progressively against us. And so while we like to promote our barbarism upon them, they are not barbaric in nature. So let us once again look at that and say, for those that are less, shall we say, benevolent, there's also a line in the sand to which they will not participate either. In other words, taking a life causes consequences to your own self. The law of karma doesn't allow you to escape. No matter how hard you try or how smart you think you are, you still are responsible for putting things in action. And therefore, if they wish to, shall we say, manipulate things, they do so by our own weaknesses. And it's not that we don't have a choice, but they come and say, okay, well, if you cooperate with us, we'll give you fame if that's what you want, or fortune if that's what you want, or egotistical gratification. And few people can resist such temptations because they're all about me, me, me. And pretty soon you become a willing puppet. And then you go ahead and do somebody else's business that isn't even your own. And that's how the majority of this field has evolved here in the last 40 years. And so, yes, we do have forces that try to work against us in a way, but all thing in nature has balance, and so you have forces that countermand that. It all comes down to one simple principle. Which are we going to choose? The choice is never forced upon you. That is a total misnomer. The choice is yours. And if you choose it, well, then you're going to walk that path until you choose otherwise.
You know, one of the things that I think is most impressive about George is that he had films of the craft, he had photographs of the craft, and there were other eyewitnesses to some of his sightings as well, weren't there?
Absolutely. There were 8 other witnesses in the desert, 6 and George, so 7. And there were dozens of witnesses on the property. When you look at the book, you will find on his world tours, I've included the articles, that wherever he went, there were reports of sightings, whether it was New Zealand, Australia. He stopped in India and talked to the professor of the Hindu University, and they talked about it. Pakistan, there was an interesting little caveat of this discussion there. Europe and England, everywhere. And so the fact is that he had support of his space contacts. Whether people want to believe it or not, that really is their own prerogative. I can only say I've met some of them, and I have been very privileged to interact. And so, you know, that's my own journey, and if that offends some people, well, they'll have to get over it. But the idea here is that George had to have that support, because when you go out amongst the public in the way that he did, and brought this information forefront, front and center, if you don't have some support, people tear you to pieces. And they had attacked him quite vigorously in some places, too. But yes, contrary to some people's opinions and insinuations, no one has been able to disprove Adamski's photographs. No one. And that means that the laboratory that put out the negatives, they have put out an affidavit that's in the book. The Kodak engineer, William Sherwood, did an analysis of the Rutherford Adamski film in 65. Other people have done a series of telescopic, investigations into the craft and how they are emanating some radiation off of it. They call biometric radiation analysis. And it goes on and on and on. And somebody recently said to me, well, Glenn, you know, when you write the new book, you should take the old negatives out and send them to a new lab and let them go through the whole thing. And I said, you know, that cost me thousands and thousands of dollars. And once I print that again, somebody will say, well, we don't like that. And what about this and what about that? It's an endless skepticism, because we don't want to. We'll embrace the fact that their UFOs. We're getting more and more accustomed to that thought. But we don't want to embrace the fact of life in the solar system. Well, they'll admit, and I did a lecture a couple months ago, and when I asked the people, they said, oh, there can't be life in the solar system. Our probes have said this and this and this. And so I said, okay, how many of you believe what you're being told by the government or the military today? And they all said none of them. I said, at the same token, you're taking information based upon the conditions in space and gulping it down like a big grouper on a hook. You get a single source information. At the same time, you say you don't believe, but at the same token, you do believe. Make up your mind. And I tried to put some of that discontinuity between what we're told and in regards to the solar system and Mars and Venus and things like that in the book as well, because there's a huge discontinuity between one set of information and another set, and it changes all the time, and our instrumentations aren't doing very well, and we use the same instruments in the Atacama Desert down there in Chile that we sent to Mars, and those instruments say there's no life on Earth. So, you know, people really have to waken up a little bit.
Didn't George meet with some high-ranking people in the UN as well?
Oh, absolutely. Uthant was a very strong promoter of this information, and George met with him in January of 65. You see some of the correspondence that has been, the letters have been put in the book and illustrations. He talks about some of the scientists that he interacted with. Some of the names, the so-called names in this field, you know, Alan Hynek and Major Kehoe and Frank Edwards and some of the other ones. While everybody likes to sweep George under the rug, they all did a lot of corresponding with him at the same time looking for information. And that's one I wanted to give the people a look at, see as well. And George, he didn't care. He says, I don't care we use my name. Don't use my name. What's important is that the information gets out. George used to carry a piece of one of the ships. He had a small piece of one of the flanged, the outer hull of it, molten metal. And he gave a piece of that to Wilbert Smith, who was in charge of Project Magnet in Canada. And, of course, Smith talked about having a piece of metal, but he didn't talk about where he got it from, and it really doesn't make any difference. But the idea is that it was there and available for analysis and so on and so forth. And so George worked his behind off in order to try to enlighten this society and this civilization, and, you know, they tried desperately to ignore him, no matter where I go. So I give a little bit of it gives me a little bit of pleasure to rub their noses in it occasionally.
George also met with high-ranking people in the Air Force and the military here in the U.S.
Yes, in fact, when we met him, my father had we had that sighting in downtown Washington in March of '63 of this bell-shaped craft hanging about 1,500 feet over downtown Washington. There was a reporter for the Washington Daily News there on the sidewalk, along with many other witnesses, and it was reported in the paper a couple days later. I have it in archives, which will go into the new book that I'm working on our, my family's personal history and story regarding this field. It's going to be called Can Truth Prevail? But anyway, so my father went to the Library of Congress, looked under Adamski's A for Adamski, starting alphabetically, and Flying Saucers Have Landed was there, including inside the spaceships of the same craft, clearly photographed. And he wrote to George. George lived in Vista, California, where I presently live now, and we have lived since 1972. And he was coming to lecture to the Air Force Reserves in D.C. And that's how we first met him in the summer of 63.
And Glenn, you've had some of your own personal contacts as well, correct?
I've had the opportunity to interact, I was a witness at a very young age with George in the house, because there were times when the family, my parents and the Rutherfords, were busy arranging press conferences or television or radio. George was often on the Inga show, NBC in the D.C. area, Boston and other places. And so during this time when there was a great deal of activity, because when George came to town, there was a lot of activity, and we had the security agencies, the CIA, parked down there at the bottom of the driveway. My father used to walk down and give them coffee out of the thermos. And so, you know, these people don't waste their time if you're a kook. They will only watch those who they think has information of importance. And so there were times when I was with George alone. We were sitting on the dining room table. He would say, oh, there's a couple gentlemen coming to visit. We're going to discuss, and you're going to listen. And that's how it came by. And these people would come, and they would talk about where it would be advantageous for him to be ready with the camera at certain dates and times. You just can't arbitrarily film in those days like you can today, where everybody has a camera in their phone. In those days, you looked around a heavy 8 or 16 millimeter camera, and you had a little tiny viewfinder that's, you know, half an inch wide, and you had to know how to use that thing. And so these films that George got were indicated by the space people that where he needed to be in order to take these films successfully. And so after GA passed away, my father had the same contacts. He described some of them in his book, Why Are They Here?, that he put out in 68, and his first book by Vantage Press. And so we've had the privilege of, shall we say, encountering them over the decades. There is no predetermined schedule. They come if they feel they need to, and they make certain things, relevant, and talk about things that need to be done or should be done in a different way and what have you. For instance, George's fourth book, which was mentioned in this one, I did that on purpose to make sure people understood there was more material that George had composed, and because there were always accusations that other people had ghostwritten his material, which is absolutely nonsense. And the fact that all those people were gone and he continued to produce material is another proof of that. And so, but they have been, I don't think I've seen about 10 or 12 years since the last interaction. And it's not a sit-down question and answer sessions. It's basically this here for a particular purpose, and that was that. And off they go, and off we go. So they have important things to do. They live purposeful lives. They come from a different place, and they will go back to it and continue to live the principles that they have learned over so many thousands and tens of thousands of years, while we continue to squander our opportunities here simply because, once again, our own inability to choose.
Glenn, how old were you during that first contact that you described?
Oh, there were already several. I started around 4, then the ones with George around 6, then the ones with my parents when I was 8, and the continuing ones of the same individuals. Then down in Mexico, we had a ranch near one of the bases that George had informed us a location of, and so that was from 69 to 72. Now, there were several circumstances there, as well as with the Mexican military police, and who came and told my father, we've read your abbreviated Pentagon file, and we know what you're about, and we know that these space people and these crafts are here, but we know the exact quote was, we know they're here, we know they're good for us, but we don't want them. And
really?
If you go amongst the people and try to educate them, then we will deport you. So, but that all will go in the next book too. But basically then, and then a couple other circumstances in the 70s and Europe and 80s with my father's lecture tour in 81 when the book Alien Bases came out. I always found it so interesting. I watch Ancient Aliens and some of these other programs, and recently they had books, about the moon formations, and they used a book called Lunar Anomalies by Alan Sturm. And the funny thing is, Sturm collaborated with me in order to get a certain amount of pictures to put that in there, and they will never mention my father's book or George's name, ever. And in fact, they used several of the pictures in the program, but they're public access pictures, they're NASA pictures. But it's another form of staying away from anything Adamski. They are just scared to death of that.
So there was an ET base in Mexico near a ranch. Did your father own that ranch?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's the reason we bought the property there.
Really? That's incredible.
Absolutely. Before George passed away, he described the area to us. And he also was had the thought in mind to go ahead and move to this area in Mexico as well, to get away from the pressures and the harassment that was occurring in this country. And of course, he passed away before that happened. But he had done that before, in the mid 50s, I believe it was 58. He had a place so that he would go down in near Guadalajara, in Lake Chapala area. And they enjoyed it a great deal. A group of them all went down there. But George described this place, and then my father went and acquired the property. And then, the locals would say, yeah, we see these things, glowing crafts coming over the hills and disappearing behind this particular mountain and not coming back out. And then we went up into the high hills, as high as the roads and trails would go, until you hit heavy forest areas. And there was a small village of maybe, 50 people. And they looked at us real strange. And my father, through the interpreter, asked them, well, why do you look at us so strange? He says, well, we see people like you, of light-skinned and, combed and cut hair and suits. They come out of the woods, both men and women, in this attire from nowhere, and walked down the road till they got to the main highway and stood there and waited on the corner until the bus came by, and off they went. He said, we've seen lots of them come out, but we never see them come back. So,
how interesting.
And to many people, they are highly unnerved by this particular thought. We have become so programmed that anybody amongst us has such negative, threatening purposes behind them, that they really become very uncomfortable with the thought that people walk amongst them from other planets. But the idea is not any different than you have people from other countries walking amongst you. You can't tell the difference unless they have an accent. We're a largely homogenized planet, and many different cultures exist side by side, and it's really not difficult for them to walk amongst us and acquire the paperwork. We have millions that don't even have that in this country, so it's not difficult.
Well, Glenn, we are pretty much out of time. I wanted you to have the opportunity to tell people about your website and anything else that you think is really important.
Yeah, I highly recommend the new book. I think that it will give a lot of people some very substantial information. You can find it on ABE Books, ABE.com, which is as big of a bookseller as Amazon. And we can find it on our website. And if they contact us directly through our Adamski email, gafintl@aol.com, they can order from me, and we can arrange through PayPal. And so we're making the book as available as possible, and it can go on our Facebook page, which is George, then a space, Adamski Foundation, one word, and you'll find a lot of, we must have, several hundred people around the world that talk about many different subjects. It has nothing to do entirely with just George. It's just an open forum. So I welcome everybody to take a good look at it. I think they will not be disappointed. And we will continue to put out the work as well as we can.
And your website is AdamskiFoundation.com?
That's correct.
Okay. Well, folks, Glenn, let me just say it's always a pleasure. I always just enjoy talking to you. And here's another great book. I mean, you're doing great work, and I always appreciate our time together.
Mark, I appreciate being with you. You've always been a very gracious host and a very open mind, and so I appreciate the forum to promote our material and this message.
All right. Hopefully we'll talk again soon. Have a good evening.
You bet. I look forward to it.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.